Hey, Ajahn Kruna, most talk today truly resonated with me. While years of breath practice has yielded only a few, albeit very important, experiences of concentration on the cushion, I've grown more and more clear about the depths of my defilements and the programs that run through my brain. Wow, I'm neurotic. I'm feeling a bit hopeless, but can this possibly be good? Rather than an object and trying for a concentration, should I focus on something else for a while until I've developed skillful means? Is it possible that one's karma is such that deep concentration is unlikely, or that the background mind can be too aversive for concentration? I really need some anatta here, don't I, with gratitude. I think one of the things is it's always, I think I've been really trying to encourage people to be experimenting and seeing, well, what actually works, because it's nice to have a very rational, idealistic program to goals, tools, and whatnot. But if they don't work, then one has to really experiment and try to figure out, well, what actually works. Because one of the things that is really helpful in terms of that, and taking an interest in different skillful means, is generated by interest, and that's important. That there's that fundamental interest to be that helps to kindle effort and sustained attention. And yeah, and different temperaments, different background minds are different, and some people will be adept at concentration, some people will not be, and that's not so important. The main thing is that it's being utilized for the, say, whether it's one is adept at concentration or one is not, one has to be utilizing it for the increase of wholesome dhammas and the decrease of unwholesome dhammas, because that's the more important basis for growth in the dhamma. Is it skillful to dig up sensual thoughts and contemplating on the ugly side of it during vipassana? And I also like to swap the order of precepts around when it gets dull. Is it a waste of effort? No, similar, just that the order is not that important or necessary. The main thing is that one has the kind of the basic principles down. Digging up sensual thoughts, you usually don't have to dig very far. I wouldn't be trying too hard. I'd be more careful. Today I saw a milk carton being thrown away. I'm not sure if everyone knows they are recyclable. This sight initiated a fire for me. I told myself, it's just something thrown away. Then I told myself, it's just my mind on fire. Can you speak about right view? Does it come back to what I can truly know? How do I consider long-term patterns that may not be apparent right away? One milk carton is not a big deal. One carton a day starts to add up. So anyway, one of the fundamentals of right view is not... the main thing is around the aspects of, again, karma, recognizing where one creates those patterns of suffering for oneself, suffering for others, and then in particular, the being able to recognize, well, what is in accordance with truth, reality, but then it's also about what is it that is going to decrease suffering. And we can be right and still create tremendous suffering. We can only really effectively influence others skillfully when we're not creating suffering for ourselves or suffering for others in the process. It's really important to be that aspect of right view, coming back to suffering and the end of suffering. When I return to the world of speaking again, what would be a good quick mental check-in that I could use before I open my mouth and possibly make a mess of things? Any tips for right speech? Is it an aphorism? Say, a closed mouth gathers no foot. That's not the Buddhist. The Buddha would have us reflect on what is true, what is timely, and what is a benefit. Because something might be true, but it might not be timely, and it might not be so beneficial. But that's a criterion that the Buddha used and fulfilled, was that it's true, it's timely, and beneficial. An example that Ajahn Chah would use of, in terms of speaking and, say, admonishing or bringing up something that's difficult in community, he'd always say, don't bring up these issues before the meal. Everybody's hungry, waiting for the meal, and it's just bad timing. Wait until after the meal. People are happy, comfortable, they'll be able to receive it better. Because even if it's true, timing is of the essence. Can brightness of the mind and mental fatigue coexist? Is mental fatigue a defilement? Yeah, it can. I mean, just off the top of my head, in the sense that the mind can be bright, but then there's still being a certain mental maybe fatigue or a kind of, maybe one has been engaged in something that has made the mind kind of fatigued, but there can still be a brightness there. And what pops into my mind is during the time of Ajahn Chah's cremation, I was very much involved in the preparations for the cremation and funeral ceremonies. It was like a year-long preparation, so that by the time the actual event took place, there was definite mental fatigue, but tremendous brightness because of the wholesomeness of everything that was happening, and the kind of the goodness of the event and the people that were involved, so that there was a tremendous brightness, but a definite fatigue. So that the mental fatigue is just natural, in the same way that your body gets tired if you're maybe doing a lot of physical work, and your mental fatigue can be the same, and not a defilement. It's the sometimes when there is mental fatigue, then one's mindfulness and one's kind of restraint can be down. So then it opens up the doors for defilement to enter, or can be a cause. The reflection on the parts of the body and the whole body were so helpful in helping me concentrate and relinquish. Is it possible to read that reflection somewhere? Will it be on the CD? Signed, this is not me. I think he was making it up as he went along. And there's a certain pattern that it isn't as if it was out of a book anywhere, but it'll be on the CD. And I think that's also, if I can speak for Kruna Dhammo, in the sense of just by experimenting with different templates and different types of reflections and contemplations of the body, then these different recollections will come up. Could the summary of this week's rich teachings be represented graphically? For some people, it is helpful to see the flow of a process visually, including all the players, interactions, and scenarios. There are so many details in a chain of events and easy to miss one. Well, one might be able to represent it graphically if we actually knew what we were doing. We just showed up, and it's just been coming, and it's just what's been coming out. Meditation is work. Sometimes I'm very tired, can't think, can't hear, can't sit, can't sleep. I just show up and breathe. How are you doing? What keeps you going? I'm so touched with your generous presence, patience, and deep commitment. With gratitude. Well, thank you. I think one of the things with meditation is that really trying to get a handle on that non-self aspect. That's where meditation becomes a lot of hard work sometimes, is when not only are we having to watch the breath, relax the body, attend to the thoughts, we've also got to carry this self around as well. That gets to be very burdensome. So that being able to step back into the quality of relinquishment and letting go, so that, of course, it's that observing and watching that you start to see those patterns, and you see, oh, wow, that's those patterns that where one is either obsessing or worried or working to try to make it some particular way that it ends up being, it gets very tiring. So that, and we all go through that. There probably isn't anything more difficult than working with the mind and understanding it. But then it's always helpful to try to hold that perspective of the freeing quality of letting go and relinquishment, how important that is, not central. Ajahn Chah, remember him once saying that there's only two things you need to do in Dhamma practice: knowing and letting go. That's it. Just to know and let go. Know and let go. It's that much. What is the position of the monastics in relation to the lay community? Are we viewed as essentially impure and filled with defilements? I read that somewhere. I'm not sure what your library list is. No, I mean, it's the whole function of the, from the time of the Buddha, it's always been set up as an interdependent relationship, and the monastics benefiting from the relationship to the lay community benefiting from the relationship to the monastics, and that happens on so many different levels, and we each have our strengths and weaknesses, and the reality, of course, is that when somebody ordains as a monastic, then their defilements ordain with them, and that's what they're working with. Which is more powerful, loving kindness or knowledge of suffering? It seems that our noble silence and internal mindfulness put the retreatants, and to some degree the monks too, in the mode of not making eye contact, not sharing a smile. Isn't there room to be mindful of our Dhamma friends, even if we don't really know most of them, by offering the simplest expression of Dhamma friendliness, a smile? Am I too concerned with other people's actions? Meditation is serious business. You know, we spend so much time interacting, feeling compelled to interact, feeling worrying about how people view us, trying to present an impression to other people, that for 10 days to step back and have a rest from that is a real gift. So that, day after tomorrow, Sunday, there will be no shortage of contact. Once breakfast comes, it's that opportunity to really step back is a gift to oneself and gift to others. As I say, we spend so much time worrying about what impression we're making and how to make a good impression on others. It's a burden that we can set aside for a short period of time. Two questions. I'm having alternating intense periods of spaciousness and intense periods of agitation and sleepiness. Can you speak to this? I seem to identify very strongly with both states. It takes some time before I see the dukkha. I feel a bit hopeless about identification and the possibility of relinquishing it or even getting some relief from it. Any guidance would be appreciated. There's a couple of aspects in terms of perspective, in that as we train and practice, it's quite natural for there to be a kind of, it's not steady yet, it's not consistent, so that, to be able to experience a period of spaciousness and then you see it slip away. And sometimes what happens is once you've experienced a spacious peace, the experience of agitation or sleepiness seems all that more heightened or exaggerated. So that tendency to identify is kind of fundamentally the problem that is the generator of the dukkha, in the sense of one experiences spaciousness and say, wow, this is great, this is how it should be, this is what I've been, where have you been all my life? And then it's not there, and it's like, one identifies with that, I was always like this, blah, 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 and you tire yourself out, and of course it makes you sleepy. So it's where the image that Ajahn Chah gives of what the duty of a practitioner is the same as if in a comparison with a gardener. A gardener's duty is to prepare the soil, you put the fertilizer in the ground, you put the tree in the ground, you water it, you keep the bugs away, and then the fruit will appear according to the nature of the tree itself. If it's something that gives fruit really often and easily, then it'll come out. Like if it's an apple tree or something like that, it's going to take many years before you'll see fruit. But the duty is still the putting the attention into that preparing the soil, the watering it, looking after the tree, and that's what we pay attention to in our practice. And whether there's spaciousness or whether there's agitation and sleepiness, those are equally natural. But what's more important is the attention that we put into the looking after the roots of our practice. Is the experience of Nibbana, that is the cessation of all formations, the same for a stream enterer, once returner, etc.? Or does the experience manifest differently depending on the level of realization? Do the suttas or commentaries touch on this subject? Any stories from the forest tradition related to it? In the texts, that experience of Nibbana, it's actually the same for stream enterer, once returner, in the sense that one is getting a glimpse of that and seeing clearly the cessation of becoming and a window into the relinquishment of the stream of attachment and desire. So that experience is the same, but then it's experienced differently in the sense of strength or manifestation of it would be a bit more clear, longer lasting in the later stages of the path. And I'm not 100% sure that it's clearly laid out in the suttas. I'm just sort of trying to remember where that memory is coming from. And I'm not 100% sure whether it's suttas or commentary that speaks of that. And for the in terms of the forest tradition, in terms of comparisons like that, nothing's coming to mind. How do the Thais, and especially the Buddhist practitioners, perceive the flooding disasters in Thailand? Is it just an unfortunate chain of effects due to bad weather, and that is how it is? So, neutral, no feelings? I'm sure there's lots of feelings. It's affecting a huge portion of the population and affecting the economy. There's like 1,000 factories flooded. I mean, it's like I saw a picture of the Honda factory, and it's all you could see was water with and just the tops of the cars. It's all submerged. 30% of the hard drives, computer hard drives on the planet, come from Thailand, and it's all affected. So, in terms of economic difficulties, the disruption of having to flee one's house and getting by in flooded, smelly, fetid water. Everybody's, it is sort of seen as, this is definitely something they're having to deal with difficulty. Probably some are dealing with it more graciously than others. As there's a person I know who's a good Buddhist practitioner, his house was flooded out. The house he's lived in for 20-odd years, his house that he was building and just about complete, that's flooded out. His office for his work, his business, was flooded out. The warehouse and factory for his business was flooded out. And at his home, so he evacuated his family. He looks after both his mother, who is wheelchair bound and not at all well, and he also looks after has his wife's mother living with him as well. So he moved the whole family to higher ground in about 2.5 hours outside of Bangkok. And sort of said, "Well, how are you doing? I've heard that this has happened." And he said, "Well, you just have to deal with it. You have to work with it." He said, "And for me, it's not such a problem, because at least I've got the material well-being enough to move my family. I really feel sorry for the people who don't, and there's lots of people that don't have that luxury." So it's very compassionate, not really looking at focusing on his own difficulties, but recognizing, wow, there's people who are, have got a lot worse than I do. "You mean all I have to do is drop dukkha from the mind? Why didn't you tell me that years ago? You wouldn't have listened." Is atammayata, it's with an M, atammayata, like nippapancha? Nippapancha is non-proliferation. I think atammayata is, although it is pointing to non-fashioning, non-proliferation, non-identification, it is a bit more say the a result. Maybe nipapancha is like that. Non-proliferation is more like an activity, and the atamiyata is more like a state. So that's how I see it. Would an opposite of dukkha be contentment not dependent on conditions? Dukkha is used in different ways, so that if one, in its more sort of prosaic, dukkha and sukha, so happiness and suffering, sukha being happiness. But in terms of dukkha being within the the cessation of dukkha in the Noble Truths, a description of it could be contentment not dependent on conditions. One's not reliant or dependent on getting things the way one wants or needs or desires or prefers. There is a stability and a rootedness that is one of the words that's used is unshakable. Would you say Nibbana is a constant conscious choice, creation, which is ultimately easier than creating dukkha? It's not so much a conscious choice, because it seems so clearly that one isn't having to choose between being peaceful or clear, or it's not an option to create dukkha anymore. It just doesn't make sense. The heart doesn't go there. And I'll maybe give an example that's a bit more, not on a mental level, but on a member Ajahn Chah saying, for the heart of one who is freed, it wouldn't matter how much coercion or enticement, it wouldn't matter how much you sort of tried to pay somebody to just take your finger in and kill an ant. Just couldn't do it. Somebody with a pure heart, a freed heart, wouldn't be able to do it. Just not there. Do you have any ideas or feelings on the question, who created life? Did Buddha know how it all began? That's one of the things that the Buddha said it's not necessary or useful to pose as a question. And the Buddha tried to make his teaching as practical as possible rather than speculative. And then even if one knew who created life, if one was still creating suffering oneself, then it's still one hasn't solved the problem. So if this body is elemental and sustained by some force of nature, no self present, why do we have individual senses of I am witnessing? Kamma? Question mark. So when we all become enlightened and end the cycle of rebirth, and I'm hoping for tomorrow, noonish, then what? Another question. After his enlightenment, did the Buddha ever feel anger or sadness? Were those emotions wiped from his program? The thing is it's like Ajahn Chah just saying, there's a practical usefulness in having, say, like an I, and then having other people. He says, if I would like to ask one of you to go out and do something, and I just say, person can do this for me. There's these conventional realities of I and personhood are, but they're just that. They are a convention that one has to rely on. And the problem of that the Buddha is trying to address is the problem of creating suffering, difficulty, confusion, where one is taking, I am witnessing and therefore I am have an eternal self, or therefore I am a a good person who should be praised and treated nicely, and or I am witnessing, but my witnessing is not as skillful as it could be. I'm a flawed witnesser. I'm deeply flawed. So that I start spinning out into identification, and there's where the problem is. Certainly, after the Buddha's enlightenment, that which would be a source of dis-ease, discontent, dissatisfaction, suffering in some way, even some little niggling thing, that's gone from the mind of the heart of the Buddha. And it's being able to see things so clearly that one isn't, that doesn't enter into one's mind. Of course, and then the question of, say, when, you know, we've all become enlightened, then what? Well, it'd be probably a less complicated world that we would live in. Can you please explain more about Bodhisattva's path? How can a being cultivate wisdom and avoid becoming a stream enterer? Bodhisattvas must not realize the Dhamma all the way to last life. Is this correct? Through the power of intention and resolve, that things fall in line with that, so that when one sets an intention, a resolve, a desire, you know, things fall into place accordingly. I'll give an example. Is the example of Ajahn Mun's teacher, and Ajahn Sal. He was a very diligent practitioner, and he was Ajahn Mun's initial teacher, and then Ajahn Mun went off and practiced on his own. And at that point, after he became enlightened himself, and reflecting on his teacher and out of gratitude, and also Ajahn Mun had some special powers, and he could see that Ajahn Sal was, his resolve and determination over many lifetimes had been to become a Pajeka Buddha, a fully enlightened being, but enlightened on their own. That was his, with that resolve in the mind, there was, say, he wasn't interested in, say, arahantship in this lifetime. And so Ajahn Mun went and explained it to him, and then gave him kind of a, pleaded and invited him to set that resolve aside so that he could realize the Dhamma in this lifetime and benefit people in this time, this era. And so that's what he did. So it's around the kind of resolve that one formulates and keeps strengthening, and that desire of what one wants to do. Did the Buddha have chanting in his time? Did he create any of the chants, or were they all created after his passing? The way that the teachings of the Buddha were learned at the time of the Buddha and then passed on amongst the students and disciples was through recitation. That's basically what we're doing with chanting, is that reciting particular verses. Of course, some of the ones are created after, like some of the ones that are more devotional verses, although some parts from the Buddha's teachings are incorporated in it, say like the nine qualities of the Buddha. Say, Arahaṃ Sammā Sambuddho Vicca Jarana Sampanno Sukhato Lokavidu. That was spoken by the Buddha describing himself, so that those are incorporated in some of the chants. Some of the chants are teachings that the Buddha himself gave, say like the ones that the suttas, those are teachings that were compiled certainly around or near the time of the Buddha, and then they're passed on, and or chant on the four requisites. That's a teaching that we chanted this morning. The Buddha's words on loving kindness that we chant in English. The verses that we did, we chanted in English. I will abide pervading with. The Pali of that is the right from the suttas of the Buddha's description of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. The verses of sharing and aspiration, that's something that was written after, so that some come from the Buddha's time, some don't. They are, as I said, it was how the teachings were passed on. Like there's a couple suttas where the Buddha meets a monk and fairly newly ordained, and the Buddha asks the monk to recite a certain section of the teachings, and then the Buddha praises him in his both his memory and his diction, and that he's kept it clear and he's remembered. So that in ancient India, that oral tradition was actually writing. Writing was known at the time of the Buddha, but it wasn't considered appropriate for religious teachings to be written down. That was kind of low and mean type of thing to do. Accountants and people, secretaries for kings, did the writing and wrote sort of worldly things, but religious and spiritual subjects were considered more important to be memorized and passed on through memory and recitation. So that during the time of the Buddha, then you'd have groups of monks who would learn teachings or sections of teachings, and then that would be their duty, their practice, and they'd be reciting that. And then after the Buddha passed away, then there was a council came together and there was a recitation of the teachings to clarify and compile the teachings as they were remembered. And then after the time of the Buddha, 100 years, 200 and some odd years, then there were convocations where they would get these monks from all these different places, they would recite together, and then you'd have reciters and listeners. And when somebody is, you know, out of sync, and then you've got to stop and figure out, okay, which was the right word, what was the right phrase, and so that the texts didn't come about until about 400 years after the Buddha passed away, that when it was written down. So that many years, but on a certain level, the trust was not in the written text. The trust was in the memory, memorization, the chanting. Say even today in Burma, there are monks who can recite the whole Tripitaka, which is like 45 volumes of Pali, the suttas, the Vinaya, and the Abhidhamma, and they can do the whole thing. There's not so many of them, but I met a couple of them a few years ago, and you know, they start learning when they're young, and when they're questioned on it, they're actually. You don't get to start right from the beginning and go through, because that's fairly easy when you're memorizing. But they're actually sort of given a phrase sort of in random places. Then they have to pick up from that and then be able to recite it. So they've got to just know it front, back, right? It's just, I mean, I forget the chants that we do. know, those are pretty diddly. Dhamma advice, please. For one who wants to maintain a clean and sober life after this monastic retreat. I think one is just that reminding oneself of that intention and drawing close to good friends in Dhamma, setting up routines for oneself that are helpful and supportive, listening to Dhamma. These days it's easy to listen to Dhamma. So just there's Buddhist groups all over the place, there's MP3s, there's webcasts, everything, lots available. I'm thinking of visiting Wat Bananachat for practice, but the idea of shaving my head and eyebrows terrifies me. What do I need to know? Well, you just know that it'll grow back. You know? How do you open to suffering, yours and others? I think one of the in terms of opening to suffering, is that sense of recognizing it's a common denominator, actually, that kind of links us as human beings. This quality of suffering, in you know, whether it's tiny or whether it's a lot or however it is, it's one of the things that we share, and to be able to recognize that, it's sometimes easy to either objectify those suffering beings out there or to be obsessed with I'm the only one who suffers, or I'm the best sufferer, the most accomplished sufferer. Thank you for your wise and generous teachings. I'm at once grateful and also feeling sad. Every story and reference is about a man. Were there no women at the fire sermon? How come there is no talk of the female disciples? Perhaps the next Buddha will be a woman. Can you speak to this absence of a female presence? One is, I'm a man, and I've lived with monks, so that's my experience. So I can only talk from my experience. And certainly in terms of the question of the fire sermon, there weren't women present at the fire sermon because it was very, very early days of the Buddha's dispensation, so that it wasn't until some years later that the female order of bhikkhunis was established, and then there's a parallel order of female disciples, and then the Buddha gave, say, like when he talked of, say, his foremost disciple in wisdom, Sariputta, then he had a parallel component, or the foremost disciple, male disciple, for psychic powers was Mahamoggallana. Foremost disciple amongst the nuns in psychic powers was Upalavanna. So then there was parallels of these in the time of the Buddha, and of course in the Theravada tradition, then there is an absence of the, say, female presence from a historical background of over 1,000 years of there not being the bhikkhuni order. So that I don't think we need to wait to the next Buddha to be a woman, but because I think there's a beginning presence of reordination of the and reestablishing of the bhikkhuni order, so that over time that will regenerate that presence of women practitioners. I've appreciated your reflections on the origins and translations of key words. For example, this morning was the first time I noticed the enchantment and illusion in disenchanted and disillusioned. They seem very positive words now. Do you have any reflections on the instructions to guard the senses? That the word that is like usually translated of guarding the senses is the sangra, which means a indriya sangra. So it's both a kind of a restraint and composure, so it's not so much, because we're talking about the senses today, and that it's not so much guarding, fending off, and fighting and struggling with the objects that are coming to assail one, but it's sort of like establishing a composure and clarity and a restraint of that outflow that creates this sense of a protection and stability. So that's guarding the senses is again, once you start looking at the language and the underlying meaning, and you start teasing out a more kind of user-friendly and helpful perspective. I had a body sensation. My perception was my heart pounding, but the more I felt it, the more it separated into the actual contraction of the heart muscle. Was this sensation, perception, mental formation? And is it even possible to feel the heart muscle contract and the flow of blood? Lots and lots of things are possible, but it relies on the mind being clear and that attention being stable and focused. And also, one has to recognize that these are. We use these words to separate out an experience, but all these are conjoined. They're not disjoined, in a sense. They're not separate, discrete events. They're working together. But as you pay attention, then you can start to tease out a bit more. Predominant something that is a bit more present, but it's all going to be mixed together anyway. It's just the nature of experience in the mind. What is the relationship between atamayata, non-fashioning, and jhana? Are jhanas experienced regularly only by those who have experienced insight? Is abiding in atamayata the same as abiding in nibbana? So the jhanas it's not necessary to have experienced insight to experience jhanas, and I think that description of it, atamayata being the awakened experience of an arhant, so it would have an aligning with that abiding in nibbana. It's also in some ways, when it's talked about, or the way it seems to be written in the suttas, is that it's an inclining of the mind and experience. And one phrase I remember reading, sort of an entry into emptiness, so that it's sort of a channel moving in that direction. So that experience of non-fashioning, of non-identification, is not just an end result, but is also a way of inclining the attention and inclining the experience. To me, at least for now, the part of the mind most imbued with a sense of self is the decision maker. That which decided to come to this retreat, to be aware, to remember, to be aware, which part of the mind is that, and how can one gain more insight into the decisions we seemingly make? That decision maker as highly impermanent, and I was just remembering that, and to be able to have a sense of, because we tend to, again, that's how we create an identity and sense of self. Well, me, the decision maker, and then we may make a good decision, say, well, there's me, the good person, and we make a bad decision, and there's me, the bad person, and we keep spinning. So it's like you're just recognizing, obviously, we have to be making decisions, and then trying to cultivate those qualities that allow for more awareness, clarity, and discernment. You mentioned two Pali words that translate to desire, one wholesome, one unwholesome. Please restate the two Pali words and spell them, please. So the one that is always inherently unwholesome, leading to suffering, is tanha, T-A-N-H-A, tanha. And then the one that is more neutral, but generally has the, it can be qualified toward unwholesome, but generally is seen as wholesome and beneficial motivation, interest. That is chanda, C-H-A-N-D-A, chanda. What's that meat hook doing in my back? Not that again. Or my knees screaming for movement. Not that again. Or my mind racing with judgment. Not that again. Yet I settle down, breathe in and out, watch closely, and then a moment of peaceful, sublime feeling. Not that either. There, well, one feels a bit different than the other. So that paying attention to the feeling. Mm-hmm. And so as Ajahn Chah saying, yeah, that's the whole purpose of the Dhamma, the language of Dhamma is feeling, recognizing that there is a different feeling, and one wants to draw closer to one rather than the other. You mentioned the 28 Buddha's protection chant, so on page 62, it mentions several lists. 10 powers, 18 kinds of Buddha Dhamma, 32 major and 80 minor marks of a great being. Where can I find these lists? I go to Google. You can just Google it. Okay. Contemplation. The heart is still, the mind is calm, the thoughts come and the thoughts go. The thoughts are not thought about, kind of like a free riding in the mind. The heart stays peaceful. Insights do arise with this free flow. Can you please speak on contemplation as a form of meditation and these insights? So it's actually so important to incorporate a contemplation, the reflective capacity of the mind is so important to employ. You know, we sometimes over-idealize or over-strategize of how to try to make the mind peaceful, get the mind to a still, concentrated. And the ability to contemplate and turn the mind back on itself is just so important in order to understand more clearly where those impulses of desire and attachment keep coming from, how they get sustained, what their result is, and how to work with it, so that this contemplation is a necessary part of really growing on the path. You know, one has to be careful that contemplation doesn't turn into just random proliferation, but without that kind of contemplation, investigation, reflection, then we don't grow as well as we. I'm thinking of some of the advice that the Buddha gives, or that they say, like in these, bringing up chanda as the first factor of the basis of accomplishment or success, and this is in meditation. So the first one being chanda, or desire, motivation. Second being effort, energy, virya. The third one being jitta, sort of the application of the mind. The fourth one being vimamsa, which is reflection, investigation, reviewing. It has the connotation of reviewing and investigating. So that vimamsa, as contemplation, reflection, reviewing. Or in the seven factors of enlightenment. First one being sati, or mindfulness. The second factor in the factor of life is dhamma vicaya, investigation of dhamma, investigation, contemplation of dhamma, reflection on dhamma. So that the Buddha is encouraging us all along the way to be reflecting and investigating. Is the experience of jhana required for stream entry? No. And in actual fact, when you look at the suttas and you start seeing the instances where this person realized stream entry, that person realized stream entry, almost all were from listening to Dhamma. So they're not sitting there in jhana listening to Dhamma. It's either engaged in conversation or sitting and listening to explanation of Dhamma. So it's more around that establishing a right view and entering and abiding in right view. And is jhana more alert or more trance-like? Jhana being the, say, right concentration as the Buddha outlined it and encouraged and taught, is more alert. And there, that, I mean, there is old translations of the word jhana as being trance, and they're very misleading. And in order for their, certainly for growth, and because the Buddha encouraged cultivation of these refined states of concentration and consciousness. But along with that, the desired result would be alertness, mindfulness, alertness, clarity, clear comprehension. All of these are a necessary part of the path.